Good evening. Topic for tonight is the topic of, as I think it was on the flyers, the joy of Purim, costumes, spiels, and practical jokes, something along those lines. We are blessed as Jews with Yamim Tovim, as holidays, with holidays all year round. We have Pesach, we have Shavuos, we have Sukkos, we have Hanukkah, we have Purim, of course. Each of these Yamim Tovim, each of these holidays, comes with its own modes of celebration, the ways on which we make ourselves happy. The Torah actually says, V'samachta b'chagecha, you shall be happy on your Yom Tov. So it's a mitzvah that we're supposed to go out there and be happy on Yom Tov. That doesn't necessarily apply to Purim. We're going to come back to the Purim specific point. It's a general mitzvah regarding the holidays of the year. So what do we do, practically, on a Jewish holiday to make ourselves happy? What are some of the things that we do? This is why I throw it over to you. Sorry?
Sing.
Okay. Now, maybe for some of us that makes us happy, and for some people it doesn't make other people happy if we sing, but okay, yes. Getting together with friends and family. Basavayayin, meat and wine, he says. All right, he gets down to it. What else? What do people do? I mean, what does it mean to make yourselves happy on Yom Tov? You know, every once in a while in the Jewish calendar, we end up with a situation where there are 2 days of Yom Tov outside of Israel, followed by Shabbos, or Shabbos and then 2 days of Yom Tov. So you have the three-day Yom Tov phenomenon. And you hear people groan as soon as they notice that on the calendar, and they say, oh my God, that makes it worth moving to Israel, just so I could avoid having three days in a row. And you sort of say to yourself, what is this torture that God inflicted upon the Jewish people, this Yom Tov holiday, that when they hear that there's a 3-day Yom Tov, they immediately grimace and say, I don't know how in the world I'm going to make it through. I thought Yom Tov was supposed to be a good thing. Yom Tov was supposed to be a happy thing. And in truth, it is. It's supposed to be a happy occasion, and Purim, happiest of all. If you take a look on your sheets at source number 1, you find the Talmud's recommendation for how one should celebrate happily. This is not stated regarding Purim. This is regarding the general Yamim Tovim, the general holidays of the year. A man is obligated to gladden his household for the holiday. As it is written, you shall be joyous on your holiday. We understand that one should be happy and one should make others happy. And so it tells you what to buy for your household. And it says, what does one purchase for women? What should a man purchase indeed for the women of his household? Rabbi Yosef taught in Bavel colored garments, in Israel garments of pressed flax. And that has to do with the environment in which you're situated. In other words, in the colder climates you need one type of clothing, in a warmer climate you need another type of clothing. It has to do with the material they use to make it. But the idea is, buy gifts for your household, buy your wife some clothing, buy for the people whatever's going to make them happy. The Gemara also says, as you mentioned before, that you should get meat and you should get wine, and this is a way to celebrate with joy. Other holidays have other means of celebrating with joy. If you're familiar with the Simchas Beis HaShoeva, it was a massive celebration that went on in the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple in Yerushalayim, on Sukkot, with jugglers, with singing, mass gathering. It was a tremendous event. Today, shuls replicate that, but they're not as daring. In the days of the Beis HaMikdash, as it's described Talmudically, you actually had them juggling torches and juggling knives. I have yet to see the shul where anybody celebrated by doing that, but let me know if your shul does that, and I will be there. Not to juggle, just to watch. The Gemara talks about celebrating with meals in particular, making sure that you have foods that bring joy. And regarding Purim, of course, there's a practice also of drinking. Now, I want to stress and underline that those who are dealing with issues of alcohol should not be drinking on Purim. Those who have small children around who will misunderstand should not be drinking on Purim. Nonetheless, there is indeed a mitzvah stated in the Gemara, Chayiv Inish Levesumei B'Purim, that a person should drink in order to celebrate on Purim. These are all practices that people have in order to make themselves happy on holidays. The sages so liked this idea of celebrating with joy on holidays, and in particular on Purim, as we'll see, that they even justified behavior that we would ordinarily consider not only questionable, but illegal. They actually, the sages justify what we would consider illegal behavior in the name of making ourselves happy on Yom Tov, on holidays. Take a look for one example at source number 2. Hoshana Rabbah is the 7th day of Sukkot, of Sukkot. On that day, you finish using your lulav and esrog. Well, what do you do with a lulav and esrog when you're done with it? What do you do with a lulav? Anybody know? Right, save it till Pesach when you'll use it to light the fire for burning the chametz. Yes. Absolutely. Thank you for pointing that out. The palm branch that we use on Sukkot, we wave it around each day of the Sukkot holiday, 7 days, and then at the end of that, what are you going to do with an old palm branch? So you could, I suppose, give it to a non-Jewish neighbor who celebrates Palm Sunday. I'm not really recommending that. That was a joke. You wanted to know where the jokes were going to come in. That was one of them. Okay. But people keep it until Passover, and at that point they use it to light the fire that they'll use to burn the chametz, to burn the leaven. That's a means of recycling which is standard and approved. The esrog, the citron fruit, people often make it into jelly, they make it into liqueur. Right? We have different uses for it. We'll take a look at source number 2. Regarding a passage in the Talmud a couple of thousand years ago, what we did with the etrog at the end of Sukkot, the adults would remove the lulavim of the children from their hands on the 7th, Rashi explains the Gemara, and eat the esrogim of the children. In other words, the kid has the fruit, and the adult takes it and says, oh, that looks good, I think I'm going to take a bite out of that. That's actually what's happening on Sukkot. They take a bite out of the esrog. And he says there was no theft and no issue of peaceful conduct like, hey, don't go taking an esrog from a child, right? Candy from a baby, esrog from a child, don't do that. Rosh says, nah. Why? Because they did this in simcha. They did it in joy. It was considered to be a happy day. Now, we could have another class on the question of why exactly this was justified for Sukkot, but I bring it here just to show that the sages accepted and justified practices that would make people happy on Yom Tov, and this was part of the celebration on Sukkot. Even though those practices seem to be, at the very least, questionable. So that brings us to Purim and 3 issues. Costumes, the Purim spiel, and the practical jokes. So we start with Purim costumes. We're familiar with the concept of Purim costumes basically, right? The idea that people show up in shul and they're dressed up as gorillas, as Batman, as, I'm trying to think what else I've been over the years. Sorry? I never was Cinderella. I missed one. Wasn't Cinderella. But yes, Cinderella is another popular one. Some people take characters from the Megillas, right? So they'll come out and they'll be Mordechai, or they'll be Queen Esther. And as a kid, you sort of grow up your first couple of years, my first couple of years anyway, thinking that's the way it's supposed to be. You're supposed to dress up as someone from the Megillah, and it's like heresy if you come as Spider-Man. But then you start dressing up as Spider-Man because everybody else is, and you sort of leave that by the wayside. The truth of the matter is that the practice of dressing up in costume on Purim was not about dressing up as somebody from the Purim story. It's not as though Purim has this standout idea of let's act out the Megillah, where you'll say, well, let's borrow that practice for Pesach, and at the Seder we should all show up dressed up as Paro or Miriam or Badia. You know, you can think about it. This could start a trend. We don't actually do that because that's not what it's about. The history of dressing up on Purim actually goes back at least 750 years. Well, Clonimus ben Clonimus, writing in Provence in the beginning of the 14th century, describes the phenomenon. He, by the way, was not a fan of the phenomenon. He didn't think this was a good thing. But take a look at source number 3 and see his description. And on the 14th of Adar, that's Purim, for the sake of honor and beauty, young men are glorified and exalted, acting in a manner of insanity and foolishness. By the way, the original Hebrew is much better. He actually wrote this in verse. One wears a woman's dress and a necklace about his throat. One acts like one of the fools with a drum and a dance and joy. And he describes people basically partying with on Purim in this costume. You'll notice he mentions the man dressing up in a woman's dress. Show of hands, you think that's acceptable within the Torah? No, right? That no one showed their hands, but I think that's right.
Well, if it's understood that people are doing it in costume and they're not actually trying to cast themselves off as women in a real way.
Right. So let's come back to that, because that's actually an important question we need to revisit. But Rav Clonimus ben Clonimus is not a fan of this practice. Rav Moshe HaKohen mentions it for Purim in 14th century Germany and says they also did it on Hanukkah. And they also did it at weddings. People would come into the wedding that way. The Maharil discusses this as well and says they would wear costumes that had wool and linen in them. The Torah prohibits wearing garments of wool and linen. We call it shatnez or kilayim. And he says, oh yeah, people do that too. And then he goes on to justify it, and it eventually became a practice for other holidays, other Yom Tovim as well. Why in the world are we dressing up in costume on Purim? A few different suggestions. My daughter actually came home from school in Netivot with an idea that I had never ever heard before. Which doesn't mean it's wrong, it just means I never ever heard this before. It was very clever. Remember that the story of Purim revolves around evil Haman trying to eradicate the Jews. So she learned in school, keep in mind she's in first grade and she may have misunderstood her teacher, but she said that the teacher told her that they dress up in costume because the Jews in those days dressed up in costume so Haman wouldn't know who was Jewish. This way he won't know. I'm dressed up as my non-Jewish neighbor, and that way I'll evade Haman. I thought that was an interesting... Anybody ever hear that before? Yeah, it's a very good idea. You've heard it before? Wow. All right, so I had never heard this.
Question on the explanation. Wasn't Amalek proficient in witchcraft?
So, Haman doesn't mention witchcraft, although he does like lotteries. Right. So maybe he would... Maybe. I mean, in any case, he's going to know who the Jews are. They're their neighbors. Putting on a little, Groucho Marx, nose and mustache really isn't going to fool him. I'm not really asking people so much about this idea in particular, but there are some other ideas that are fascinating, including, first of all, an anthropological idea, which I found fascinating, from a writer named Jeffrey Rubinstein in an article called Purim Liminality and Communitas, talks about what are called liminal festivals within a society, where you celebrate a change of state, going from one state to another, as the Jews do on Purim, going from their state of almost being killed, going to freedom and joy and celebration. Also moving from being vassals in the Persian Empire to being freed, because after the Purim story, we know they return to Israel and they're able to build a Beit HaMikdash, they're able to build a temple. And Rubinstein points out that in societies in general, when they have holidays to celebrate that kind of a transition, they often do it with a ritual where they obscure their identity. You hide your identity as though you're erasing who you once were before you emerge as somebody brand new. Almost like the caterpillar going into the chrysalis and then becoming a butterfly. That's an interesting idea. It's not one of the mainstream ideas that we find. More mainstream ideas revolve around the story of Purim itself. One of the constant themes in the Megillah, from the beginning to the end of the story of Purim, is the theme of clothing. It is the most fashion-conscious of holidays. Where's the first clothing we find in the Megillah? Esther, Vashti, even before. This description of the fabrics that Ahasuerus has, right, at the party that he makes in the very beginning. Sorry? Exactly. And then after that, right, it's Chur Kapas Yitzcheles also. But after that, you have Vashti's downfall when she refuses to come out and dance before the king without the clothing in that case. You have the beauty pageant for Esther and the description of the garb and the makeup and the grooming of all of the different contenders for the title of queen. Mordechai comes to Esther to report the news. And what's Mordechai wearing? No, when Mordechai reports the news of Haman's decree, sackcloth, right? Sak va'efer, he's wearing sackcloth. What does Esther do to prepare to greet the king? Batilbash Esther Malchut. She clothes herself in royal garments. Mordechai goes out and is honored in a parade, and he's wearing all sorts of regalia. Haman on the other hand, comes home filled with trash and then has to change for the party. That was Yosef. That's Yosef. But he has to prepare as well for Achashverosh's party. Mordechai ends up traveling around the city and ultimately being honored with the position of being second in command to the king, and he has all sorts of royal garb that he wears. All through the story, we learn about the clothing worn by the players. And so clothes themselves have great significance for Purim, and they mark transitions for us. And so that's another answer. Another approach to why we would have special clothing on Purim. Take a look at source number 4. The Gemara asks why God puts the Jews through the events of Purim. If God doesn't want us wiped out, what exactly is he doing? And so the Gemara explains that it goes back to the period when the Jews were in Babel, were in Babylon, under King Nebuchadnezzar, and some of them worshipped idols not because they were idolatrous, but because they figured they'd rather do that than get killed. They were afraid that they would be killed if they didn't worship the idols. So take a look at source number 4. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai told his students, the Jews only participated for show. They worship the idols for show, to pretend. So God said, oh, let's pretend it's a fun game. I'm going to pretend to wipe you out. God only threatened them for show. Says Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai's read of the Purim story. And so we dress up and put on this facade in costumes to mark that. That's another suggestion. An additional suggestion that I've seen comes from Hasidic works and isn't about Purim specifically, but it's about the effect that you have when you take on a costume. When you wear something unusual, when you wear something even that's a little bit absurd, what happens? Well, you act that way maybe, but what else? Identity changes. You laugh. Right? When you see something unusual or absurd, it makes you laugh. And you know, we tend to enjoy laughing at others, so in particular, getting to see other people in costume. The idea is that it increases your celebration, increases your joy for that day. And so one of the primary reasons behind dressing up on Purim, beyond reflecting themes from the Megillah, and beyond you know, liminal festivals of the anthropologists, is simply that it makes you happy to see people in costume. So that costumes were not the province of children. Costumes were something for adults, like what Clonimus Ben Clonimus describes. Adults were the ones who were dressing up in costume, including the man putting on the woman's dress, as described by Clonimus Ben Clonimus and many others. Now, what do you do with the prohibitions? What do you do with the wool and linen? What do you do with the prohibition against cross-dressing? So in terms of the Chatney's issue, the issue of the wool and linen, the answer was very interesting. The Talmud describes people who sell wool and linen clothing for a living. Right? I'm selling wool and linen clothing. That's my job. So I don't sell it to Jews necessarily because they're not supposed to buy it, but I sell it in the general marketplace. Well, am I allowed to put it on to model it for people? The Talmud says yes. I am permitted to put it on in order to model it for people because I'm not really wearing it. I am displaying it. It's on me for the sake of putting on a show for people so that they can see it and admire it. Well, the same thing is true regarding a costume. And therefore, the Maharil, one of the preeminent early Ashkenazi halachic authorities, said, it's not a problem. This is just a display. When you want to know why Ashkenazim do the things that they do, have the traditions they have, the answer often comes back to Maharil. He is one of the authors of early Ashkenazic practice in Germany in the 14th century. So that's his justification. What about the issue of men dressing up in women's garb and women dressing up in men's garb? How in the world do you justify that? Well, along the lines of what you suggested before. That prohibition has two different roots. One view, this is the view of the Rambam, is that it's about idolatry. The concern is that priests of idolatry, certainly in Egypt, but even in later days, had a practice of taking garments from the opposite gender and donning it themselves, as though they're channeling the traits, masculine and feminine traits of their gods. And so according to that, it doesn't matter why I wear the other garment, it's off limits. But others explain that's not the concern. The concern instead is trying to masquerade as the opposite gender, right? Think of all the television sitcoms over the years where a man dresses up as a woman and ends up in some place where he's not supposed to end up. It's comedy on television, but within Jewish law, it's a no-no. So according to the view that that's why we're not allowed to dress as the opposite gender, where it's clearly just a game that's done for the joy of the holiday, it's actually considered to be justified. Take a look at source number 8. I jumped a couple of sources in the interests of time, but take a look at source number 8, Rabbi Yehuda Mintz, writing in, I believe he's 15th century Germany. He says, in our case, one does not intend to wear this for immorality, but rather to enhance the joy of Purim. Therefore, just as they did not erect a fence regarding theft, since it is only for 2 nights in a day, and what he's referring to here with his comment about theft is something I'll come back to in a minute, so too here, theft and adultery emerge from the same root in a person's nature. He says they figured it's only for a couple of days, it's done in the name of joy, we'll be alright with this practice of dressing up. What he's talking about with theft is something we're going to come back to under practical jokes. So wait for it, we're going to come back to the theft. But what we've said so far then are that Jewish holidays in general involve attempts to try to increase our joy. Purim in particular involves an attempt to increase our joy, and the first step in seeing that is the costume. Second, the Purim spiel. The Purim spiel is actually very old, but it didn't start out as a Purim spiel. Purim spiel literally is a skit. And usually what's done is there's a play or there's someone who recites Gramen poems which make fun of something, generally speaking, someone. We had a rule in my shul before coming here, as was mentioned in the bio. I had a shul for a dozen years. So we had a rule in my shul that the only person you could make fun of in the Purim spiel was me. Because I didn't want to have to worry about all the other people who were going to get insulted, then I have all the fights that I have to mediate and solve. It was much easier for it to be me, and nobody minded, because they liked making fun of me, so it was good. We all came out happy. But it actually is a very old practice that starts not with a spiel, and not with skits making fun of people, but rather with the practice of burning Haman in effigy. Take a look at source number 9, Rabbi Nassan Baal Ha'aruch, writing in late 10th, early or early 11th century. He says, on the days of Purim, the global custom, so by his day, he already thinks it's a global custom. This is widespread. It's not something new that he's describing. It's something that predates him. The global custom is for young men to make an image of Haman and suspend it from the rooftops for 4 or 5 days, which is interesting. Anybody know what else we keep on public display for 4 or 5 days? We don't get to do it today. Maybe we will next year. Sorry? No. The Korban Pesach. The Korban Pesach. The Jews in Egypt take the lamb on the 10th day of Nisan, and they leave it out for everybody to see for 4 days before bringing the Korban, before bringing the offering. And it's a public statement that we are going to take the Egyptian lamb that they worship and use it as our offering to God. That's the Korban Pesach. Well, he says they take Haman and they hang this effigy of Haman from the rooftops for 4 or 5 days, and then on Purim to make a bonfire and throw the image into it. They stand around it and sing, and they have a ring suspended above the fire, and people jump through it from one side of the fire to the other. That is a happening Purim party. If Sasa V'Simcha is planning on a Purim party, I recommend these entertainers. But do not try this at home. That's an old, old practice. How old is this practice? Goes way back before Rabbi Nassan Baal Ha'aruch. I said he thinks it's global in his day. It actually goes back centuries and centuries before that. It's an old enough practice that it was banned by the Roman Emperor Theodosius in the early 5th century. Because he thought that it was actually an anti-Christian event. He believed that the person being burned was not meant to represent Haman, and in fact, there are signs that there were elements that were Christological in it as well. So this is actually very old as a practice. Theodosius banned it, but it outlived Theodosius. They eventually, though, it morphs into the Purim spiel, perhaps caused by one too many people not succeeding in jumping through the hoop above the fire. We go for a more tame approach and instead have skits. We find it in German Jewry in the 15th century. Interestingly, it mirrored a German practice of putting on such things. The skits tended to be based on the Purim story or other stories from Tanakh, but they would warp the story a little bit in order to incorporate community leaders who they wanted to mock. It spreads into Poland, northern Italy. The first Yiddish one on record is from the year 1555. And then eventually, as I said, it became a monologue and it became poetry. It also caught on in the yeshivos as a way to fundraise. They would actually take it on the road to people's homes, and they would put on the skit in your home and raise money from you that way. Eventually, around the 18th century, they brought in the practice of the Purim rabbi. And the Purim rabbi was someone who generally was inebriated, and he would stand up and dress as though he was the rabbi. And I'm not recommending this, folks. I'm not getting myself in trouble. But he would dress up as the rabbi, and he would stand up, and he would speak as though he was the rabbi of the shul. And except the things he would say would be things that the rabbi of the shul would never say. And so it was meant to mock that way. The Sfardim, interestingly, seem to have been unfamiliar with it. It only first shows up in Sephardic communities in the 18th century, and they didn't like it very much. It seems to have been more prevalent among Ashkenazim. Well, once again, like with the costumes, we have a problem. We have very strict prohibitions in Judaism against embarrassing people. Right? We're not allowed to embarrass anybody in any way, shape, or form. Take a look at source number 10, please, on the second side. The Talmud says, all who descend to Gehenna, to hell, also ascend, also come out, except three. One who lives with another's wife, one who embarrasses another in public, and one who creates a negative nickname for another. That's pretty harsh. So, if we're so against embarrassing people, why are we justified in having these Purim celebrations at which people are going to be mocked? It seems to have been justified as something that's done for the sake of simcha, for the sake of joy. Well, it's all in fun. Well, he knows that we only mean it in fun, and therefore he'll be okay with it. Boy, is that a recipe for disaster. But that seems to be the justification that was used. And then a third practice. The practice of practical jokes on Purim, and this goes back to the theft comment that we saw before in an earlier source, in source number 8. In addition to hanging Haman and jumping over a fire, and in addition to dressing up in costume, there was a practice of jousting on Purim, having two generally young men sit on horses and charge at each other. Was considered Purim sport. It also went on at weddings sometimes, not involving in-laws. This was all in fun. And in addition, they would also take each other's property. They would take things from each other, like as a practical joke. And that was, again, part of celebrating on Purim. Does this go on in anybody familiar with this? Anybody ever see this on Purim? No, we're so tame these days. I mean, really, you're going to go to your shul, and they're going to make a big thing about the kids begging for Haman and how terrible. And you're like, come on, that's not for him. Yes.
I could have been practical just being a simple story.
Yes.
Where's that come from?
Right. So this practice seems to have spread from Purim to other Yomim Tovim as well, and specifically Simchas Torah. It became a thing that people would do it, not just Simchas Torah, but Hoshana Rabbah. So that on Hoshana Rabbah, that day that I mentioned, that's the last day of Sukkot for Lulav and Esrog and all that, when people would go around the Bima, so other people would indeed play tricks on them. And it's funny, because we consider Hoshana Rabbah a very serious day. The Chazan gets up in a kittel, we're praying for the year's rainfall, and yeah, they're like stealing each other's talitot, I should say. The practice migrated over to Hoshana Rabbah, it migrated over to Simchas Torah. It does seem to have started, though, as a Purim practice. That was the way that they would celebrate. Yes?
Isn't there something with Mar Yom also? steal people's, the kids would steal stuff and burn it at some...
I don't remember seeing that, but it wouldn't surprise me.
No, I think there's elements of wickedness for itself as a separate...
Right. I don't remember seeing that, but it could be. This was considered to be a justified practice. And they said, yeah, you can do it, and you're not going to be liable. Take a look at source number 11. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in the Ashkenazi part of the Shulchan Aruch, regarding Purim. People who grab from each other in a manner of joy do not violate the prohibition of do not steal. This is the practice, but only so long as one does not do anything violating municipal edicts. And what he means there is that if the rabbi gets up and says, no stealing, and I know it's a joke, but no stealing, then you're not allowed to do it. But other than that, he says, yeah, sure, it's fine. Rabbi Chiel, that he's writing that, keep in mind, the beginning of the 16th century. Fast forward another 400 years, beginning of the 20th century, and Rabbi Chiel Michal Epstein, writing in Novardok in Poland, said, you know what, we don't do this anymore. In source 12, he said, one who harmed another must pay. For today, due to our great sins, all joy is dimmed and we are not on this level. He says, we can't really get away with doing this and call this a celebration anymore. We don't celebrate that way. Nonetheless, for a long time, that's the way that that people did it. That's the way they celebrated Purim, with the costumes to increase joy at the absurdity of the costume, with the spiel done to make people celebrate with joy despite the concern for embarrassment, and with this practice of practical jokes. Now, the sages did have mixed feelings. Even as they justified what was being done, they still felt, you know, this is not necessarily such a great thing. This is not necessarily a wonderful thing to do. So take a look at source 13, where Rabbi Moshe Isserles wrote, not in the laws of Purim, but in laws regarding financial litigation, still if it appears to the court that they should create offense against this, they are so empowered. The court is licensed to act against it. Other famous authorities in latter day years, talking about the last couple of centuries, also came out and said, you know, we're not so thrilled with this. And the Sfaradim, as I mentioned, really were against it. The Sfaradim felt that this really was over the line. Why? It's not that they felt joy wasn't worthwhile. They felt joy was worthwhile. But they were worried about where it might lead. Take a look at source 14, please, from the Washington Post. I don't know whether this made it big on people's radar screens. It made it big for me on my radar screen, being an American originally. This is about a snowball fight at the end of December in Washington, D.C. You may be familiar. The author is somebody who got arrested in that snowball fight. He says, you may be familiar with the great snowball incident of 2009. The Post put the story on its front page, and it appeared on CNN, Fox, and other major media outlets. This mostly friendly gathering at the corner of 14th and U Streets Northwest began harmlessly enough. But things got ugly when the combatants pelted the personal vehicle of a D.C. police detective. Anyone here hear about this? Oh man, this is great. They decided to throw snowballs at the car. Now, they didn't know it was a police detective's car. It's this big Hummer going through the square, and they throw some snowballs at it. Guy gets out of the car, and they think, all right, so maybe a little annoyed, and then he pulls a gun. And at that point, they get worried. And then they call 911, and the other policemen show up, and they recognize him, and it's a whole thing. And sure enough, the police department had to apologize because you don't bring a gun to a snowball fight. But the incident itself illustrates the problem, which is not everybody is in on the joke. And even if they're in on it, not everybody appreciates it. And so you have this concern for where it might lead. They tell the story of a certain rabbi from the late 19th century who actually died of embarrassment from being mocked in one of these Purim spiels. Now, literally died of embarrassment, or was so embarrassed that he got sick and whatever happened to him as a result of that, you know, who can say? But that's the story that goes around, and it speaks to the seriousness of the issue. To sum up, we try to create simcha, we try to create joy for Purim, We try to do it in permissible ways, but there are all sorts of ways in which the sages justified what are clearly borderline practices, if not over-the-line practices, in the name of building up the joy. Why is that joy so important? Because we're taught that that's the core of the religious experience. The height of a human being's religious experience in the Torah is nevuah, is prophecy. And we're taught that one cannot experience prophecy when he is sad. When a person is depressed, the person can't experience the prophetic experience. He can't feel that. That speaks to two points. It speaks to the seriousness with which the Torah treats depression as a state, which is its own topic for its own shir. But it also speaks to the imperative of trying to build simcha, trying to build joy. And so when we're going to celebrate on Purim, we try to find ways to build it up. It also has another effect. It bonds people. It brings people together. People like to laugh together in groups. You mentioned before, one of the things that we do on a holiday in order to celebrate and to create happiness is that we bring people together. But that joy itself is what helps people to bond. And then finally, it increases our thanks to Hashem for what happened on Purim in the first place. The whole miracle. We're able to thank God more explicitly, with greater feeling, when we truly feel the rejoicing that comes with having been saved from harm on that original Purim. Questions? Yes. Yeah. I'll repeat the question.
My apologies. One of the lessons I learned about the Torah in the past was that one of the key lessons to learn from the Torah is that support the Jews in the community, whether it's good times or bad times, and that in terms of survival of the Jewish people out of this Torah, this was essentially a situation where they had to live. And here, in terms of the lesson learned, it seems as if the idea of let's build a community doesn't seem to transcend beyond the Purim activities. If you're talking in terms of how can we as a community, or how out of that situation does the idea of building a community?
That's a great point. For those who didn't hear it, what's your name?
Adam.
So Adam made the point that on Purim we needed to work together originally, and that much of the Purim celebration is centered around building that community. If I'm getting it wrong, tell me. Building that unity, and then he asks, how does that unity translate beyond the Purim itself? How do we take that outside of Purim to where it's needed for the Jewish community, for community beyond the Purim day? So first, it's certainly true that on Purim we needed to stand as community. You'll notice that when Queen Esther says, I need the Jews to daven and to fast for 3 days before I go to Ahasuerus, she doesn't just say, so go out and daven and fast. She says, gather together. Lech knos et kol ha-Yehudim. Gather all the Jews, that they will do it together. That unity is critical. And it's at the core of the mitzvot of the day. Because beyond reading the Megillah, which we do in public, we are also taught to send gifts of food from one to another, mishloach manot, and matanot le'avyonim, to give to the needy. In addition to having a Purim Seudah, to having a big feast. Where I think it transcends Purim and goes through the rest of the year is in the bonds created by Mishloach Manot and Matanot LaAvyonim. When we give the food to other people, the portions of food to other people, we create connections with them. And it's something that hopefully does last beyond it. We bond over food better than we bond over anything. And so the idea would be that you build a connection with someone. I got an email from one shul that they're encouraging people to give Mishloach Manot to someone they don't know. Specifically, go out of your way to give the food to someone you don't know. And I think that's a great idea, because it affords you the opportunity, in a licensed communal way, in the framework that already exists, to build friendships. And that's where I think it goes beyond Purim to the rest of the year. Question here?
Thank you.
Right, so I wondered about that also. I couldn't figure that out. Maharil describes, we said it towards the beginning, people wearing costumes of wool and linen. And it doesn't seem to me that they went out to the store and said, give me wool and linen to wear. You know, this is licensed for today, and all year long it's not, and so this is my thrill. I'm going to go out and have a wool and linen costume. I don't know. I haven't been able to puzzle that out. I suspect it has to do with the garb of the time and the era. Much as you had in colonial times in the U.S., I don't know about in Canada, but in colonial U.S., you had Lindsay Woolsey as a garment that was specifically woolen linen. So it could be that they had something like that in Germany 700 years ago. But I'm not familiar enough to be able to say. Yeah, but it kept you warm. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Points from beginning to end there. In terms of the issue of, they'll take the last thing first. In practice, it definitely is the woman who tends to keep a handle on things, whether because of the mitzvah or not. That's the way that I've seen it work out. But in terms of the overall, if you go back and take a look at the source that I gave you in the beginning, source number one, that passage there in the Talmud does take it, in fact, as a man's obligation to gladden his household. So that there's an obligation for everybody to celebrate and be happy, but the man has, under Vesamachta, a special obligation. We read it as Vesimachta, you shall make everybody happy. And therefore he has to go out of his way to purchase the things, to give the things that are going to create joy for everyone. So everyone is supposed to be happy, but the man is given an obligation of make everybody happy. There's more to it than that. I'm oversimplifying the topic because it's a much broader one than that, but that's it in a nutshell. Well, thank you very much. Thank you.